This talk is brought to you by the Thomistic Institute. For more talks like this, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
This talk is about Aquinas' distinction, drawn largely from Aristotle, between two ways we can have cognition of things. I almost said two ways we can know things, which would have sounded more like ordinary English. But the word know, at least sometimes, has a special meaning that is restricted to just one of those two ways. That gives me the occasion to issue a warning at the very start. Terminological issues and problems are lying in ambush all over the place in this area of philosophy, as in so many others. Almost anything you say can be misleading in some way or other. Partly because many words have meanings in ordinary language that don't line up with their technical philosophical uses, and partly because technical philosophical uses often vary from one philosopher to another. There is no good solution to this problem except wariness. So, beware. The talk's title invokes a distinction between science and knowledge of principles, with Thomistic modifying both of them. In other words, our two topics are not Thomistic science and knowledge of principles, but instead Thomistic science and Thomistic knowledge of principles. The basic distinction, stated very roughly, is this. In one type of quote-unquote knowing, i.e. the science kind of knowing, knowing something means knowing it as the conclusion of a demonstrative argument. In the other type of quote-unquote knowing, i.e. the knowledge of principles kind, knowing something means knowing it not as the conclusion of a demonstrative argument, but as a result of what we might, at some risk, call induction. But what these two kinds of knowing really are, and how they are related, and whether they cover all the options, all that needs some unpacking. I can't do it in only 40 minutes, but if I can do enough to get you thinking in the right direction, I'll be content. It would help to begin by making some remarks about two Latin terms, the noun scientia and the related verb scire, and the noun intellectus and the related verb intelligere. Scientia can be a pretty generic Latin word, meaning something along the lines of knowledge. In Thomism, however, it's often, not always, used to indicate a special kind of knowledge or cognition, or whatever you might want to call it. The quick and lazy way to translate scientia into English is to say science. Often, Thomists will speak this way, but it's not clear, really, whether this counts as speaking English, or instead as speaking Thomish. Sometimes you will see demonstrative knowledge as a translation, or you may see scientific knowledge, which is a bit redundant sounding. Anyway, scientia is the standard Latin equivalent for what Aristotle calls episteme. Intellectus can mean perceiving or discerning, and by extension, it can mean understanding. This extended sense is what we are dealing with here. Intellectus gets translated in various ways into English. You may see understanding. You may see intuition. Anyway, it's the standard Latin equivalent for what Aristotle calls nous. Both intellectus and scientia can be used either for acts of understanding or for habits of understanding. I'll say more about this near the end, but let me say now that mostly I'll be focused on acts of intellectus or scientia. To avoid confusion, however, let me mention briefly that intellectus can also refer to the power of understanding. For whatever reason, the power that gives rise to acts of scientia has an altogether different name, ratio. I won't have much to say about powers in this talk, so if you hear me say intellectus, I probably won't be talking about the intellect, but instead about what we do with the intellect, namely, understand things. Henceforth, I will try to say scientific knowledge or demonstrative knowledge for scientia, and I'll try to say intellectual understanding for intellectus. but I can't promise to stick to it every time. So beware. Let's tackle demonstrative knowledge first, and let's approach it by discussing something that is related to it, but in a way falls short of it, namely justified true belief. Justified true belief is a kind of stock definition of knowledge, and despite the problems it raises, it's got a lot going for it. You can't know something that's false, so that's why knowledge is said to be true belief. When something turns out to be false, we don't say, "I knew it, but alas, it was false." Instead, we say, "I thought I knew it." But true belief is not enough. For something to count as knowledge, you have to have a good reason for believing it. You have to have a justification. For example, suppose I believe that there is an eastern towhee in the vicinity. So this bird, actually, I heard one out there before we came in here, and I even saw it too. So, for example, suppose I believe that there is an eastern towhee in the vicinity, and suppose further that there really is an eastern towhee in the vicinity. This means I have true belief. Now, if I just randomly formed this belief, and by great good luck it happened to be true, it wouldn't be a case of knowledge. If, however, my belief was based on a good reason, then my belief would be knowledge. For example, suppose I hear that rather distinctive eastern towhee song. In such a case, I know that there is a towhee nearby. In such a case, I have not just a true belief, but a justified true belief. It's worth thinking a bit about how the justification that I hear a certain song is related to the belief that it justifies that there is a towhee nearby. Although we might not normally think of it this way, we can express the relation as a kind of logical argument. Such and such a song is being sounded. Whenever such and such a song is being sounded, there's an eastern towhee in the vicinity. Therefore, there's an eastern towhee in the vicinity. Again, we don't normally think of it this way. If you and I were out birding and I said all of that to you, you'd think it rather strange. Normally, one just says, "Hear that call? It's a towhee." Or even just, "Listen, a towhee." But if we want to, we can lay the thinking out as a full-dress logical argument. And now we come to an important point. Premises are not all alike. In a way, to be sure, any premises that entail the conclusion are good enough for justification. But some premises are better than others, and some forms of justification are better than others. Aristotle says, "The premises of demonstrated knowledge must be true, primary, immediate, better known than and prior to the conclusion, which is further related to them as effect to cause." Let me repeat that more slowly this time. The premises of demonstrated knowledge must be true, primary, immediate, better known than and prior to the conclusion, which, the conclusion, is further related to them as effect to cause. If we had all day, we could patiently and lovingly go through all of these points. What I want to focus on at the moment is the last of them, namely that when we really know something by demonstrative knowledge in the fullest sense, we know that thing as following from its cause. This gives us knowledge propter quid, that is, knowledge that involves knowing on account of what the known fact is true. You can think of this as justified true belief on steroids. True belief with a justification, yes, but where the justification is of a special sort, namely knowing the fact as following from what makes it be a fact. When you know something in this way, when you have full-blown scientific or demonstrative knowledge of it, you know not only that it's true, but also why it's true. You know it by way of knowing how it fits in to the metaphysical structure of the universe. Let's consider an example. We have propter quid knowledge, demonstrative knowledge, that an eastern towhee can be active at a wide range of temperatures when we know this on the basis of knowing the fact that it's warm-blooded. Whatever is warm-blooded can be active at a wide range of temperatures. Eastern towhees are warm-blooded, and so on. Our knowledge of this fact about towhees is justified by our knowledge of their nature as warm-blooded, and their being warm-blooded is precisely what explains their ability to be active at, let's say, 90 degrees Fahrenheit and 20 degrees Fahrenheit. something which is not so true of, let's say, snakes. By contrast, if we knew this fact about towhees on the basis of having seen them hopping around at different times of year, this would count as knowing it, but not as knowing it in the best or fullest sense. Here, as in many other situations, it's important not to let the best be the enemy of the good. If we know something by demonstration, but not on the basis of its cause, we do still know it. This is called knowledge quia, or knowledge of the fact. Knowledge quia tells you that something is the case without that knowledge being grounded on why it is the case. It's knowledge of the fact, not knowledge of the reasoned fact, as they say. It's not knowledge in the most full-blooded and absolute sense. It's not knowledge, but it's still a kind of knowledge, a kind of cognition, a kind of justified true belief. Let's talk more now about argumentation. If you know things, you can use them as starting points or premises that will lead you, by argumentation, to still other things, things you perhaps hadn't thought of before. This is what's at issue in Summa Theologiae Part 1, Question 1, Article 8, where Aquinas asks whether theology is an argumentative science. He means a science that uses arguments, not an argument where people are cranky, right? Whether theology is an argumentative science. He gives the example of St. Paul arguing from the resurrection of Christ to the resurrection of all men at the end of the world. And in case you're wondering, yes, Aquinas does, in his commentary on 1 Corinthians 15, give us a logical analysis of the argument. And he does go into a discussion of whether the argument is fallacious. It's not. At least he says it's not. We can see this pattern in many places in the Summa Theologiae. For example, in Summa Theologiae Part 1, Question 2, Article 3, Aquinas argues that there is an uncaused cause. And on the basis of this causes being uncaused, he goes on in the very next question, Question 3, to derive the rather non-obvious idea that God is simple. Let's say without parts or components. Interestingly, however, discovering new truths is not the only use of argumentation. Aquinas, again following Aristotle, has the idea that if we already know some things, it can be valuable to organize them into a syllogism so that the relationships between them become clear. This can result in progress, not in the sense of learning something we didn't know before, but instead in the sense of changing our already existent knowledge from knowledge quia to knowledge propter quid. For example, suppose I know, on the basis of observation, that eastern towhees are active at a wide range of temperatures. That's great, of course, but if I also know that towhees are warm-blooded, then I can put these truths together and say, towhees are active at a wide range of temperatures because they are warm-blooded. Now I know the fact of their being active in both summer and winter in a new way. I now have propter quid causal knowledge of what I formerly knew only on the basis of its effects. Okay, so much for scientia, demonstrative or scientific knowledge. Now it's time to move on to the next topic, namely intellectus or intellectual understanding. If we can demonstrate something, then we have demonstrative knowledge of it. But how do we know the premises that the demonstration begins from? In some cases, to be sure, the answer is this. We know them because we have proved them from other premises. But that raises the worry of an infinite regress. It can't really be the case that everything is proved on the basis of premises that were themselves proved backwards to infinity. It seems we can't avoid saying something like the following. Anything that's proved is proved on the basis of ultimate principles that must be acquired in some way other than by proof. In fact, that's what Aristotle and Aquinas do say. But what does it mean? It might seem like an admission of defeat. You're admitting that your whole scientific system is based on stuff you can't prove. I've actually had this argument with one of my kids about geometry. I said, but you can't prove the premises of geometry. And he said, in so many words, right, that's why this is so stupid. So it's not just a made-up thing, like this happened at the real dinner table in real life. Okay, so, yeah, it's necessary to do more than just say that ultimate principles are acquired in some way other than demonstration. It's necessary to figure out what that way is and to make it plausible that it's at least as reliable as demonstration is. Otherwise, our house will be built on sand. As I'm sure you've guessed already, this is where intellectual understanding comes in. Demonstrations go back to ultimate principles, and these ultimate principles are known not by demonstration, but instead by intellectual understanding. Intellectual understanding comes at the end of a process that is called, somewhat misleadingly, perhaps I said that before, but yeah, induction. It starts with sensation. For example, I see, hear, and maybe touch many birds. If my sensations are just going in one ear and out the other, nothing will ever come of it. But suppose instead that at least some of these sensations are somehow retained in my mind through that strange faculty we call memory. And suppose further that I am able to compare and manipulate the retained images, the phantasms, as they are called in the trade, in a way that allows me to notice similarities and differences among them. Suppose, for example, I notice not merely that this bird has the ability to generate heat and thereby maintain its own internal body temperature, but that others do as well. And suppose, after a while, I suddenly notice that all the towhees are like this. This enables me to grasp a general truth. Towhees are warm-blooded. It's not something that I have proved, if that means deduced from premises. But that doesn't mean I don't have very good reason for believing it. It's something that I have seen. Aristotle has a fascinating metaphor for this process near the end of the Posterior Analytics. He says it's like a routed army reforming. One guy takes a stand, then another, and then all of a sudden everyone has taken a stand and the unit is back in a state of combat readiness. It's interesting to wonder what in this metaphor is represented by the armies initially being routed. Perhaps asking that question is just a case of pushing the metaphor too far. But perhaps it isn't. Maybe the idea is that before we organize our impressions into intelligible groupings, our mind is as chaotic as a fleeing army. What is the result of this process? I mean, what is it that we come to grasp? So what is the result of this process? I mean, what is it that we come to grasp? Do we grasp natures like warm-bloodedness? Or do we grasp propositions like towhees are warm-blooded? If our principles don't include propositions, then we won't have principles that can serve as the premises of a syllogism. But that's what we were looking for, right? On the other hand, we can't grasp propositions unless we can grasp the natures that form the subject and predicate terms. So I think it must be that these principles are both concepts, animality, birdness, towhee-tude, warm-bloodedness, and propositions. Towhees are warm-blooded. By examining many individuals, we come to grasp general natures. By examining many individual facts, we come to grasp general truths. General natures and general truths come in degrees of generality. We can grasp not only what is common to all towhees, but what is common to all birds, all warm-blooded animals, all vertebrates, and so on. We can grasp not only a general truth, like Eastern towhees are warm-blooded, but also a more general truth, like birds are warm-blooded. Eventually, perhaps, we can get to super general truths, like being is divided into potency and act. If you are persuaded that we must have the power to grasp basic principles in a way that does not presuppose prior demonstration, you still might have some serious questions about what is going on. Here are two. First, what kind of intellectual activity is this? What are we doing when we do it? Well, we have the ability to abstract, which I took to mean, I'll give you one out of the 12 theories, to attend to certain aspects of the things we are contemplating in our imaginations while not paying attention to other aspects. We have the ability to spot similarities and differences among these things. We have the ability to grasp the generalities that emerge in all of this. Does that help answer the question? If it doesn't, perhaps that's because we're hoping for a different kind of answer, an answer that reductionistically characterizes intellectual understanding in terms, exhaustively, in terms of lower-level powers, such as raw sensation. Now, I don't mean reductionistic in a snarky way. Sometimes reductionistic answers are good answers. But here, I think, such answers won't work. I suspect that our ability to engage in induction and intellectual understanding just is a special sui generis ability. It is built on lower powers, to be sure, but it can't be reduced to them. In one of those books that I've never finished, Arthur Lovejoy's The Great Chain of Being, we run into the cool idea that each epoch has certain ideas that just seem true. In some phases of history, pessimistic ideas seem true and plausible. In others, optimistic ideas seem true and plausible, and so forth. Well, I think we live in a time in which reductionistic ideas seem true and non-reductionistic ideas seem like fantasies. I get it. I feel the pull of this myself. But what if it's wrong nonetheless? I think we need to be open to the possibility that intellectual understanding, like so much else about the human mind, is sui generis and not reducible to lower level powers. Of course, this is flattering to us humans, but that doesn't automatically make it wrong. By the way, before moving on from this discussion of the activities involved in intellectual understanding, let me briefly throw out something that someone might find important, namely idealization. Husserl talks about this, but I'm not so sure that Aristotle and Aquinas do. Suppose you have seen many even numbers, 2, 4, 6, 8, and all of a sudden you grasp the general concept of an even number. Good for you. But notice that every even number that you considered in this process was, so to speak, perfectly even. It wasn't just approximately even. I suppose there's no such thing. But now contrast this case with the case of circles. You see many circles, and all of a sudden you grasp the general concept of a circle. Here you have done something more than you did in the case of the even numbers, because none of the individual circles you encountered on your way to grasping the nature of circlehood was a perfect circle. What I'm saying here is that sometimes understanding requires not only generalization, but also idealization. This seems important to note. Moving on from the activities now, let's talk about the objects of these activities, the realities that the activities are directed towards. What are these universal natures that we grasp with intellectual understanding? How do we ever get to universal truths from observation of individual fact? One possible answer is we don't. At one point in One Fish, Two Fish, Red Fish, Blue Fish, Dr. Seuss says, "Not one of them is like another." He seems to be suggesting that each thing is unique. If so, the category schemes we come up with are arbitrarily imposed. The schemes reflect nothing at all, except perhaps the interests of those with the power to get others to accept their categorical schemes. Aquinas, of course, isn't going to agree. As he explains in Lecture 3 of his commentary on Book 6 of Aristotle's Ethics, when we sense things, we are always already in touch with universality. The commonalities among things are already there. In the particulars, the things already resemble one another. I would like to call this, and I hereby copyright the phrase, the logos of the given. What thought does not need to impose itself on reality, because what thought seeks is already there. Or, as Aristotle puts it in De Anima III, the faculty of thinking thinks the forms in the images. As some of you may know, Bernard Lonergan uses this as the epigraph of his work, Insight. In saying that the commonalities among things are already there in the particularities, or in the particulars, I mean to be entirely and 100% neutral on almost all the questions that fly under the title, The Problem of Universals. Whether one holds that the natures of things exist apart in a transcendent realm, as Plato might have thought, and Bertrand Russell certainly did, at least at one time, or whether instead one holds that the natures of things are commonalities that have a being shared across many particulars, as Scotus seems to have done, or whether instead one holds that each being is individual, while there are nonetheless mind-independent agreements of kind between things, as Aquinas holds, on my reading. Whichever quote-unquote theory of universals you hold, It doesn't really matter here. You just need to accept that it is true, independently of what anyone thinks, that there are objective similarities and differences among individual things, similarities and differences that can serve as the ontological grounding for some account of induction and intellectual understanding. The mind's grasp of principles is a grasp of universal kinds and facts that are out there, waiting to be understood. Earlier, I noted that there are more and less general kinds of principles. I'd like to return briefly to that point from another angle. For thinkers like Aquinas, there are perfectly general principles that govern all of reality, or perhaps it would be safer to say that there are perfectly general principles that govern all of created reality, leaving God out of it for the time being. However, it's also true, and this is important, that there are principles that govern only some regions or realms of reality. Matter, for instance, is a principle that is found in some beings, but not in others. The soul is a principle found only in beings that have matter, but not in all of them. Sensation is found in fewer still. This is related to my earlier remarks about reductionism. Although there are perfectly general principles that govern all beings, nonetheless, those principles are not sufficient for explaining all beings in detail, because the various realms of being have domain-specific principles that inform them, and that even affect the way the higher-level principles function. Now I want to clarify something important. What I've said so far can give the impression that for Aquinas, thought is like a geometry book that you read from beginning to end. We start with the axioms, and then we deduce theorems. The axioms are known by intellectual understanding, and the theorems are known by demonstrative knowledge. But there are at least three things wrong with this picture. First, it leaves out the messiness of the induction stage. In real life, we don't begin at the age of 7 by observing a bunch of particulars, then closing our eyes and pushing hard on our temples, and then suddenly intuiting the first principles, after which we start turning the crank of deduction on the basis of principles that don't need to be revisited. The process in real life is much messier than this, with many false starts, restarts, blind alleys, and so on. Second, it leaves out the messiness of deduction. If you have ever tried to do a proof, you know that it's as different as anything can be from just turning a crank. It's more like designing and building a crank. Third, once we have a bunch of principles and deductions, there are many ways of organizing them, and possibly no single best way, if indeed we ever do try to get all of our thoughts organized into one giant schema. In practice, then, thought is kind of a big jumble that needs constant rethinking and reorganizing. Such messiness can be detected even in the works of so orderly a thinker as St. Thomas. So the account I've been giving is, in a very important sense, very idealized. It's more a schematic drawing of a final, never quite realized product, and it's not a film of its production. Now I'd like to make some brief remarks about operations and habits. I've been focusing on certain mental operations, the actual process of deducing a conclusion from premises, the actual process of grasping the truth that I've deduced, the actual process of going through an inductive process, the actual process of understanding a principle. These processes are crucial, obviously, but there's something else to think about as well. Perhaps you've had the experience of grasping some truth, a mathematical truth, for example, and then a week later, or a day later, or perhaps just 2 minutes later, realizing that it's gone. One way of describing this situation is to say, I forgot. But I wonder how much light that really sheds. Anyway, the point I want to bring out is this. When we have learned something really well, it becomes a stable part of our mental possessions. We can call it up anytime we want to. It's like a skill that we've come to possess. A choir director said to me once, bad musicians practice until they get it right. Good musicians practice until they can't get it wrong. The Tomish word for this kind of stable possession is habitus, something that we have. You can translate this as habit if you want to, but it's a bit misleading. The point isn't that we are in the habit of thinking in a certain way, but that we're able to call up this kind of thought when we need to. Now, this distinction I'm discussing here strikes me as being pretty close to what analytic philosophers would mean by distinguishing dispositional knowledge of something from occurrent knowledge of it. A cognitive disposition or habitus is important, and so are actual occurrent cognitions. Without actual cognitions, we are basically just asleep. Without habitus, without steady and reliable cognitive skills or possessions or dispositions, we have to relearn everything every time, which makes real thinking impossible. We've seen so far that human knowledge or cognition, or whatever you want to call it, involves two main activities: intellectual understanding of basic principles and the grasp of truths that follow from those basic principles. As far as it goes, this is a pretty good picture, I hope, of Aquinas' understanding of human understanding. However, there are two complications that I want to mention. The first has to do with a certain idea about how we can get from knowledge quia to knowledge propter quid. Earlier, I noted that we could start with two bits of knowledge acquired independently and then find a valuable way of relating them, namely as cause and effect. I start with knowledge that towhees are active in winter, and also, independently of that, with knowledge that towhees are warm-blooded, and I suddenly grasp that the second is the cause of the first. But now let's consider another possible scenario. Perhaps I start with only one bit of knowledge based on observation, namely that towhees are active year-round. From there, I go on to reason that therefore they must be warm-blooded. Once I know this, I can then reverse direction and argue back to my starting point. From the fact that towhees are warm-blooded, I can argue to the fact that they are active year-round. It seems clear that I can do this, but now here's the question. When I do it, have I transformed my original starting point from knowledge quia into knowledge propter quid? In other words, can we start with knowledge quia of certain effects and then reason from effects to causes, arriving at quia knowledge of their causes, of the causes of the original effects, and then taking that new knowledge as a premise, reverse direction and reason from causes to effects, thereby arriving at propter quid knowledge of the effects that we started with? Aquinas says something that suggests this. For example, in his commentary on Boethius's De Trinitate, he says, and here comes a quotation, "The sensible effects from which demonstrations in natural science proceed are, at first, more known to us. But when, through them, we come to knowledge of their first causes, from these will appear to us the propter quid of their effects, from which they were proved by a demonstration quia." Speaking of the particular case of form and matter, Joseph Owens explains the point as follows. He's talking about form and matter in this particular case. "They are known by quia demonstration. Once they are known by quia demonstration, however, they can furnish propter quid knowledge. I wouldn't want to suggest that we can never elevate knowledge quia to knowledge propter quid. However, I do want to raise a question about whether we can do it in the particular way that was just described. We started out by knowing the fact that towhees are active year-round. This was mere knowledge quia, a perfectly legitimate kind of knowledge, but not knowledge in the fullest sense. From there, we infer that towhees are warm-blooded. That's also perfectly legitimate. But you would think that it inherits the non-full-bloodedness of the starting point that it's based on. Therefore, we have quia knowledge of the fact that towhees are warm-blooded. And now we come to the difficulty. If our premises are known by knowledge quia, how can they give rise to knowledge propter quid? How can the weaker give rise to the stronger? In the passage from the Posterior Analytics I quoted near the beginning of this talk, the one that I quoted twice, Aristotle says that the premises must be better known than the conclusion. If the premise towhees are warm-blooded is known on the basis of our knowledge of the fact that they are active year-round, then it can't be better known than this fact. So something seems to be wrong here. Perhaps it's just a matter of clarifying what's meant by saying that we can reason from effects to causes and then back down from cause to effects. Perhaps reasoning from effects to causes is sometimes really a kind of induction after all. And what it results in is not merely knowledge quia, but intellectual understanding. That would solve the problem. However that may be, I want to move on to discuss a further complication. This is a case where I think it's pretty clear that reasoning from effect to cause is not a case of induction, concluding an intellectual understanding. I'm thinking of natural knowledge of God. God, as you know, is the first and uncaused cause. He's prior to everything other than himself in every respect. Everything other than God is posterior to God in every respect. In this maximal sense, he is the first principle. Does that mean that our knowledge of God is ultimately rooted in intellectual understanding? For Aquinas, the answer is no, at least in this life. We know by quia demonstration of cause from effect that there is a first uncaused cause. Starting from there, we move along, very haltingly, to demonstrate various properties of this uncaused cause. But the original starting point of those demonstrations is not a real grasp of God's true essence. God's essence is not first cause. What this means for us here is the following. Yes, in one sense, the first principles of knowledge for Aquinas are grasped by intellectual understanding. In another sense, however, the very first principle of knowledge is not grasped this way at all. Not by us, not in this life. Instead, for us in this life, the true first principle is grasped in a different and less secure way. Maybe that means that Aristotle isn't quite right when he says that the soul is, in a way, all things. The soul is naturally suited to grasp the natures and attributes of all material things. Anything immaterial, God and the angels, for example, lies outside our realm of competence. So the view that divides things neatly into intellectual knowledge of principles and demonstrative knowledge of other things is good as far as it goes, but it really only applies to the created realm, and in fact only to the material realm. Amazingly, we can grasp the principle that lies beyond the first principles of material reality. But our view of it is weak and not proper intellectual understanding at all. We see as in a glass darkly, at least in this life. Thank you.
I have a question about demonstrative knowledge and its relationship to knowledge where the... It's not very similar when we have knowledge proper with, we have something like knowledge of some sort of deductive generalization, such as universal generalization. And from the fact that we grasp that and we see that from this universalization we get a certain this generalization we get a certain kind of cause, that's how we get knowledge proper quid. But I wonder about cases where we might not necessarily have a deduction, but we have, for example, just like a mere statistical law as one of the premises. So like maybe, for example, I see that in most of these cases, a photon goes left.
Yeah.
And I'm in one of those cases. Would that be something that can still qualify as demonstrative knowledge on this picture, or would that be ruled out merely because of it?
Wait, let me just get clear now. What's the premise and what's the conclusion? Or what are the premises and what's the conclusion?
So let's say the first premise, the statistical premise is, in most cases, photon goes left. Most of these cases. I'm in one of these cases. And therefore, most likely, it'll go. That was it.
So the conclusion is also stated statistically.
I was thinking the most likely is kind of a shorthand for therefore.
You shouldn't conclude therefore, right? I mean, it might be a good
it's
bet.
Very likely.
Yeah, but then why not say it's very likely?
I think you could say both. I guess I just think in certain cases, you would have enough reason to actually say the conclusion is true.
So I'm not trying to be, I feel like we aren't onto your real question yet, but I'm just getting hung up on this. So let me think of a different generalization, right? Men are taller than women. So if you say now, in the next room, there's one man and one woman, and you go, well, I just know the man is taller, then you're stupid, right? Because it doesn't always work out that way. If somebody made you bet, okay. But it's just not always true, right? It's just true generally. Now, anyway, so I'm trying to see if I get a grip on the point of this question. I think you can certainly argue from statistical generalizations to such and such is more likely than not or extremely likely enough for all practical purposes. That would count as sort of full-blooded knowledge propter quid if the starting points of the argument were somehow the causes of the conclusion. So now we have to get into all these philosophy of science questions, right? So if you hold that this statement about the general behavior of these electrons or whatever are just kind of generalizations. They don't necessarily tell us anything about the essences of them. Then it might not be a very convincing kind of knowledge through causes. But if you think that somehow it's giving some kind of insight into the actual nature of the objects, then it's closer to being that. I'm reluctant to like make a lot of confident claims about, you know, the quantum mechanics, right?
I just wanted to ask about the point near the end. You're talking about going from a weaker premise to ending up with a stronger one. So it was the case right with the bird, where you say, okay, the bird is active in summer, winter, therefore it must be that it's a warm-blooded bird, and then on the basis of that inferring, this kind of knowledge poker quiz about it's being active in winter and summer. And so your solution was right to say that it's induction in the first step. So there's actually some, like, the process is mainly like the, where you gain the strength from. So you
know, yeah. Well, maybe not exactly the process, but the process has a kind of culminating act, and that act isn't just inferring the fact, but somehow seeing the fact in a more intellectual understanding kind of way.
I was wondering if there was just a simpler way of going, right? Where we suppose, I mean, the reason that I'm able to infer from the fact that this the eastern bird is active in winter and summer, fact that it is a warm-blooded bird is because I have some sort of knowledge of this generalization that animals that are active in winter and summer are warm-blooded.
Okay, so that's serving as a premise or a conclusion?
That's serving as a premise.
Of the conclusion? Oh, yeah, but that's a... Wait, so state it again?
Isn't it just a simple argument that you have the eastern towhee is active in winter and summer?
Yeah.
All animals that are active in winter and summer are warm-blooded, therefore the eastern towhee is warm-blooded. And then on the basis of that, we're able to then go back and explain why.
I don't know. I feel like I'm lost. So there's like this very specific point, right? So the eastern towhees are active all year round, therefore they're warm-blooded. Okay, so that seems like a good argument. And you can argue the other way, too. My question was only, if the only reason that you know that they're warm-blooded is that they're active, it looks like that, I mean, it is an argument from cause to effect. So it sounds awesome, like this is this very special, glorious kind of knowledge. But on the other hand, if you look at Aristotle's official list of all the things you need, one of them is it's better known than. And I don't know that here it's better known than the original just observation that they're active year-round, right? So I'm guessing, so if this is something that we can do, there must be something more than just this argument. But it must have prompted, in a kind of inductive sort of way, this insight into this general fact about eastern towhees.
Okay, so if we add in the, I guess I look at that argument and I think, I don't know anything about animals, and so I think, oh, well, how do I know it's warm-blooded on the basis of it being active in winter and summer? I would need some sort of more general premise about being active in winter and summer and warm-blooded.
Oh, just to even to make this work?
Yeah, yeah.
Sure.
Right. Okay, so the problem that you have is if any of the premises are lesser known, and that's the issue. Even if
I see. So if any of the premises are lesser, well, it just strikes me that would be the question I would raise, right? If any of the premises are lesser known, then isn't the argument only as strong as its weakest premise, or the conclusion only as strong as the weakest premise of the argument? I mean, that sounds like a safe thing to say. I'm not trying to make a big deal about this, but this business about going from causes up to effects and then back down. Like, people do talk about this as a way of constructing a kind of Aristotelian science. And I used to think I understood it, and then when I was working on this paper, I was like, wait a minute. So, yeah.
Well, thank you very much. I was wondering if you, this, I have like two kind of related questions for clarification. You seem to express a little bit of hesitance with the use of the word induction, and I was wondering if I could prompt you to maybe say a little bit more. I think induction nowadays, you know, has connotations involving like probability and statistics, and I think it's come up in some of the other questions. But like for St. Thomas, you know, there's none of that involved for Aristotle. There's no, you know, 97% this or stuff like that. And so I was wondering if you could maybe clarify, like, in what way, like, maybe our contemporary notion of induction is maybe like inadequate or something like that. But also, I was really interested in the example you brought up. Between grasping the essence of or the nature of evenness versus the circle, and maybe if you could speak a little bit maybe about the order of certain inductions that we have. Like, for me, it seems like following the Aristotelian insight that we begin with what's most evident to us, not with what's most evident itself. It seems that we would start off by grasping the nature of a circle first, and then evenness would come out somehow later. But it seems like the way if we got to evenness, there's some sort of induction, it'd be a different sort of induction.
All right, let me see what I can do. So for the first one, you were on to the issue I was worried about, right? So this is called induction in scholastic terminology. Just means we're being led into something. But then in modern philosophy, we have this problem, right? Every swan that I've ever seen is white, but so what, right? Why should I jump from that to the conclusion that all swans are white? And this, you know, I'm choosing this example on purpose because it's this classic thing, right? Somebody went to Australia. Of course, there had already been people there. They knew that swans were black, but yeah. So it turns out, yeah, not all swans are white. So this is the kind of thing that's supposed to scare you into not forming generalizations. Okay, it's an interesting point. There is such a thing as jumping the gun on these things, and we all know people who like induct from two examples and stuff like this. It's super annoying. So I think that's actually a legitimate problem in how you know when you can jump and the ways in which it's fallible and all that. Those are important questions. I think, you know, without having gone into it very much, I think Aristotle and Aquinas have this idea that you're not just going from, well, it happens most of the time, so what the heck, let's say it happens all the time. It's not like that. It's that somehow this will trigger an insight into the nature of the things, and then you can see it. So if you pick examples of things where it's more likely that we actually do have an insight into the essence of it, it becomes a little bit more plausible. So if... suppose you were like, you had a ton of geometrical shapes made out of wood all scattered across a table, you know, and you were fiddling around and you were like, I really think these all belong together. And somebody said, well, why? And you're like, I don't know, but I'm pretty sure. And then all of a sudden you go, wait a minute, these all have five sides or whatever, you see. So then you would see it. Now, this is more than just having a general, more than just jumping to conclusions. You're actually, okay. So that's the kind of, and how that relates to what, to sort of inductive science. You know, I think it depends, right? Sometimes scientists are making generalizations, and other times they are having insights into the way things go. But that's a hard thing to accomplish. Okay, now the other thing, I mean, about evenness and circles, I wasn't trying to suggest that you could get from insight into evenness to insight into circles, or the other way around. So I don't think there's really any question about which of those is prior relative to the other. I was just saying that if you arrive at a notion of perfect evenness, you've done so on the basis of considering a bunch of numbers, all of which are themselves perfectly even. Whereas when you arrive at a notion of perfect circleness, you've done it on the basis of having observed a bunch of circles, none of which is perfectly even, or circular, circular. So you've kind of made an extra leap in that case. And I don't really know how that works, but I just thought I wanted to mention that it appears to be something that actually does happen.
Yeah, my question or comment on that that the abstraction of evenness seems to be like almost like second order sort of abstraction, because numbers aren't things that we in the Aristotelian way of thinking, aren't things that we see.
Yes, you're right about that.
So, but we, numbers are things that we have to abstract, and then if we abstract evenness, it's something that we abstract from numbers, which is circles that we abstract from, something we can see a circle. So it's like this kind of more immediate sort of abstraction than evenness.
You're right about that, but if we've abstracted numbers from pairs and quadruples and sextuples, there's still, the pairs are perfectly pairish, and the quadruples are perfectly quadrupular. And so I still think there's no idealization that's going on.
Just to propose a hypothesis. Maybe the difference between induction, at least as we currently think about it and understand it, is that in the contemporary understanding of induction, we're looking for regularity of occurrences.
Okay.
From which we can generalize and predict future occurrences. And the point of understanding is really, it's predicated on there being a form, which modern induction really does not accept, but that there is a form, and that the point of the discernment is to grasp the form and its essential property. And when you believe that through that iterative dialectical process of inquiring about the form, and you then grasp, you think you've got the essence and an essential property, you then have knowledge of a universal premise from which you can then proceed with demonstrative knowledge.
Yeah, that sounds like the sort of basic Aristotelian picture. That's right. The more I talk to people who know more about actual scientific practice than I do, the more I've started to think that that sort of really stark picture where you just deny the existence of forms and essences and it's a mere statistical regularity, the more I suspect that this is actually like what philosophers of science say and not what scientists think. I think that some scientists are more realist than their philosophical interpreters are. And that's sort of a quibble, but it seems to me worth mentioning. This may be a problem created by philosophers at least as much as one created by scientists. But yeah, you're looking for insight into the natures of things. And that's what enables you to get that stronger kind of demonstration, if you can get it. As was mentioned, Aquinas sometimes seems skeptical about whether we can actually get it. I've heard that some people think that people overrate this. I think somebody told me that Norman Kretzmann wrote an article arguing that people overinterpret these claims of Aquinas, but I haven't actually seen it. I don't know. I would be interested, but I do, yeah. Aquinas sometimes acts like we don't know the essences of anything, really. So if that's true, you get a kind of chastened Aristotelianism, because what he says instead is that you sometimes know the proper accidents of things. So you know like facts that hold universally of these things, even if they aren't really their essences, they flow from their essences, and it's kind of like as good as the essence.
You know the essence by its effects, as opposed to penetrating the essence itself.
Okay, I mean, whether knowing the essence by its effects counts as knowing the essence or not, I don't care to argue about.
It's just meant to show that our knowledge of the essence is imperfect.
Well, it might be. I mean, in an extreme case, the essence, our knowledge of the essence, I mean, it would be a total black box to us. All we would know is its effect. We'll leave it there, but maybe we could talk more, because I'm not sure we're meeting yet. Okay, thanks.